We now then take our second bite at this issue of envy. I wish I had a fifth, a sixth, and even a tenth bite at it, but this will conclude looking at envy, and then we'll go on to the seventh commandment. This morning we want to look at this idea of envy, but considered collectively, or considered as how it might instantiate itself on a cultural-wide basis and become the foundation for the working order of a culture, and how we might be able to identify that. I'm trusting that in an examination of institutionalized envy in a culture will help us to understand why Proverbs 27:4 suggests that envy is something that is nigh unto impossible to stand up against. 27:4 is also another passage that deals with envy there in Proverbs. Wrath is cruel and anger is a torrent. But who is able to stand before envy? Is what the writer in Proverbs 27:4 says. So we're considering this question, envy, because as we looked last week, there are some that have said within church history that envy is the mother lode. It is the well from which all other sin springs up. In other words, what they're contending is that if you trace a sin far enough back, eventually you'll come to envy. Others have said, no, it's not envy. It's pride is the mother lode. It's unbelief, some have said, is the mother lode. It's selfishness that some have said. None of these are good sins, obviously, that we want to be familiar or conversant with in terms of owning for ourselves. But yet, envy is one that of those four that I just mentioned that doesn't get usually a lot of look or a lot of examination. So we continue to look at envy. We move to this question of envy because of how it is connected to the sin of murder when we start talking about the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. In that sixth commandment, as the Heidelberg explained it, we had this question and answer. But this commandment seems only to speak of murder in question 106. And the Heidelberg answered, in forbidding murder, God teaches us that He abhors the causes of murder, such as envy, hatred, anger, desire of revenge. And then He counts all of these murder. He counts these murder. Now, obviously, envy, hatred, anger, desire for revenge, they're not all as the same thing as murder. You don't go to jail for having hatred in your heart or anger. You will go to jail for literal murder. So they're not all the same thing. They don't all have the same consequences. But God counts hatred, anger, desire for unjust vengeance, and envy as murder. It's the sin that leads to murder. He abhors it because envy is a cause thereof. And so as we look at envy, it's because it was tied to this sixth commandment. It's because it's seen as being the mother lode by many in church history as the well out of which all other sins springs forth. Remember we talked about last week that some of the ancient literature suggested that Satan's fall was because of his envy for God. Some have suggested that Adam and Eve's fall was envy because they could not have God's position. When Cain killed his brother Abel, some have traced that out as having its cause in envy. Talked about these matters last week, and so those words are just by way of review. Last week we then set the table for our discussion on envy. We considered some significant scriptures that teach on envy. We'll look at some more this morning. We briefly trace out how envy has been spoken about by some of the early church fathers by doing a diachronic study of the word envy. We could have spent a lot more. I have tons more quotes that I didn't go into because time does not permit. We spoke about envy on a personal, individual basis. We warned ourselves off against this idea of envy. And then we concluded by looking at some solutions to this problem of envy on a personal, individual basis. As we can now continue this week, as we look at envy, though, more on a collective basis than on an individual basis, we return to the definition of envy that we settled upon last week. So last week when we talked about envy, and we need this in order to know what we're talking about when we use the word envy throughout the message this morning, envy is the sin of jealousy over the blessings, prosperity, character, and achievements of others. But more than jealousy, it is the positive anguish over the good of others and joy at the anguish and misery of others, even if that anguish and misery does the envious no discernible positive good. While being indignant might find its roots in the injustice of the well-being of evil persons, envy is not indignation. Envy finds its roots in the happiness of good people. In brief, envy is paying for the good of others, and it's most commonly found in those whom wish to lower others, even if that lowering of others does not mean that they will therefore rise. And so we can understand why the psalmist can say it's rottenness to the bone, or the Proverbs can say it's rottenness to the bones. We can understand why in Proverbs 27:4, the writer can say, who is able to stand before envy? So great is its hatred. It's all-consuming hatred. Envy is wounded by our neighbor's prosperity. Envy finds pleasure in the ruin or harm of those of whom we are envious. Envy is sickened at hearing praises of those of whom we envy, and recoils at the virtues of those upon whom our envy is pointed. And the irony, which we'll explore this week, is that envy only grows more intense the more it's assuaged by those who are being envied. There is a word that we often use that comes out of this. Maybe that you haven't heard this word before, but sometimes it's a trendy word, so you may have heard of it. It's called Schadenfreude. Have you ever heard the word Schadenfreude? That's right. Schadenfreude is the idea of taking joy or delight in another person's misfortune. And so you see somebody fail, or you see somebody ruined, and all of a sudden you have this sense of joy that's called Schadenfreude. It stems from the idea of envy. This morning we want to see why the writer of Proverbs views envy as being such a fearsome enemy that he can say who can stand before it. Indeed, envy is a fearsome enemy. In Scripture we find envy stirred up against godliness. One reason that people envy other people is their godliness. We see that in the book of Daniel. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps. When it says he distinguished himself, it means that he lifted himself up. He showed himself to be superior. Why? Because he had an excellent spirit that was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and the satraps, who would have been his peers likely, sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault in Daniel. Then these men said, we shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of God. They were setting out to destroy Daniel. Why? Because he distinguished himself. What does that show? That they were full of what? Envy. They wanted to pull Daniel down. And so here we find an example of envy over godliness. We likewise find it in the story of our Savior that we looked at last week. They brought him before Pilate. You remember for what reason? For envy. Envy is this thing that wants to see others pulled down that distinguish themselves, that are godly. Not only does envy show itself in godliness, it shows itself against the prosperity of others. The psalmist can say, for I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Envy stirred up against then those who are favored or successful. So not only do we find envy against the godliness and envious against the prosperous, but we also find envy against those who are successful. In 1 Samuel, we find it with David and Saul. Now it happened as they were coming home and David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing and probably doing that Mideast thing. You know, you've heard that before on TV, right? Shouting out. And they were saying this: Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David tens of thousands. To me they've only ascribed thousands. Now what can be have, but what can he more have than my kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward. And what is it that's animating Saul? Envy. Envy. He must see David pulled down. So Proverbs 27:4 can rightly ask, who can stand before envy? And in the last few examples of envy, we saw how it can work on the basis of an individual against another individual. We want to probe this morning what it looks like as a collective culture operates with envy as a foundational starting point for the culture. Surely if Proverbs 27:4 is correct that envy is a powerful enemy on a personal basis, how much more so is envy a powerful enemy if it becomes part of the bowels of our culture? Organized cultural envy then produces, I'm going to submit to you this morning, two children, one of only we'll have time to look at this morning, another, the other child I'll have to look at another time. But these two children are called egalitarianism and resentment. Resentment we'll have to save for another time, sometime in the future. What we're saying is that when envy's in place on a cultural wide basis, what it produces as a consequence and as a result, as a offspring, is egalitarianism. And we're going to trace that out. Since envy is concerned with bringing the successful, the prosperous, and the superior person down, the long-range effect of envy on a culture as a whole is to produce a culture where all are the same. And we'll use the word equal there because that's commonly what it means. They're equal in the sense of nobody being allowed to distinguish themselves like Daniel did by way of ability. An envious culture will set cultural-wide norms that are not to be exceeded. There'll be a kind of cultural coercion towards mediocrity. And the mediocre will be increasingly defined downwards. This most often reveals itself via the move to ensure that all think alike, that all belong to the same social class, and that all share a similar heritage and inheritance. So we'll take those three and we'll look at them. Envy produces an egalitarianism where what's required is that all think alike. We might want to call that intellectual envy. For example, in our educational programs, we have largely institutionalized envy so that those who have the skills to excel in learning are held back in order to ensure that those who are slower and perhaps are not as gifted are not left behind. These programs are well-intentioned, but it has the effect of doing what envy always does, and that is to work to level achievement to the level of the underachiever. The one who might academically distinguish themselves, if given the opportunity, is retarded in their achievement out of our desire to make sure that all advance together. This is intellectual envy. And this is what it begins to look like as we instantiate it so that it has its roots in our culture as a whole. A second example, in our culture with its mass media, as it's owned by a comparative number of small outlets, what is moved towards is a mass communication that gives people the same information, resulting in groupthink. The groupthink makes for an egalitarianism in opinion and goes long ways towards achieving the goal of envy by ensuring that there will be protection against originality in thinking, protection against free and unfettered intellectual exchange of ideas, and protection against superiority in the thinking of individuals who have superior skills in those areas. Remember, the goal of culturally institutionalized envy is to pull down the superior so that the result is a grand leveling effect. This results in the creation of mass man, or what we might otherwise call the herd. Can you say? Everybody is alike. And the goal is to keep everybody alike. Yes, it's egalitarianism, but that egalitarianism we're suggesting this morning is born of this thing that Proverbs says, who can stand before it? This thing that Proverbs says is a rottenness to the bones. This thing we call envy. Envy is like that whack-a-mole game at the fair that you can sometimes play. Whenever any one of the moles pop their heads up, what happens? Bang! You knock him back down. Kurt Vonnegut wrote a short story that kind of portrays this. And I want to give you just a flavor of what Vonnegut wrote in 1961. The name of his short story was Harrison Bergeson. And it's a story about that takes place in the year 2081. And it's a time where everybody is finally equal. The envious have done their job. Bonnevue goes on to describe the conditions of this equality brought about by the culture-wide presence of envy. Quote, they weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal in each and every way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th and the 212th and the 213th Amendments of the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. This government enforced equality was achieved by imposing prosthetic technologies on those who were above average. These prosthetics, however, were designed not to enhance but to diminish. So, for example, ballerinas who might otherwise rise above their peers in grace and elegance and beauty were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot. And their faces were masked so that no one, seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face, would feel like something the cat drug in. Then there were those of above average intelligence, like the title character's father, George Bergeson. Quoting again, he had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their intelligence. Whenever George began to formulate a complex idea, which often involved questioning the status quo, a sharp, piercing noise would shoot in his ear, distracting him and derailing his train of thought. Sometimes the noise was like a siren going off. Other times, like somebody hitting a milk bottle with a ball-peen hammer. Regular and insistent, the distraction overwhelmed and undermined natural intelligence. Bonnevue captures something of what a culture looks like that has given itself over to envy. A third example of this idea of all required to think alike. The first was educational, intellectual envy. The second was cultural-wide envy. The second was information envy, so to speak. The third is political correctness. Conforming to a belief is defined as conforming to a belief that language and practices which can offend political sensibilities should be eliminated. You see, once again, there is a cultural-wide norm that's set for where we're allowed to think, and we cannot go beyond those boundaries. There's this leveling effect that we talked about earlier. Political correctness has this goal, this leveling conformity where all think alike, thinking that leads to conclusions that one's lifestyle should be preferred above another, or that another lifestyle is inferior, because it is inferior, as God describes it, is not allowed. Because those who are living the inferior lifestyle use envy as a tool to make sure that all lifestyles are what? The same. No lifestyle should be preferred or spoken of above the other. Remember, all of this is connected to this idea of culturally institutionalized envy. I'm trying to give you a brief picture of what that looks like as it gets into the culture as a whole. And remember, we back it up one more step. We're saying that envy is connected to this prohibition of murder. That's the train of thought that's brought us to this particular point. And so the envy of the intellectually mediocre establishes a conceptual standardization so that it may denounce and condemn those who don't conform to the officially approved thinking mode. And by now, of course, you no doubt understand and see that I do believe that our culture, the culture that we're now part of ourselves, that this egalitarianism, which is born of envy, is part of the soup that we live in, is part of the culture that we swim in all the time. But we don't see it. Why? Because the ancient Chinese proverb says, when you want to know what the water's like, don't ask a fish. We're steeped in it. We have it at each place everywhere that we turn. And so we're apt not to see it. And so we consider it in this morning's sermon. Not only is envy related to all thinking alike, but also envy means that all have to belong to one class, one social class. We might call that class envy. FDR in 1936 in that 1936 campaign, he ran against the economic royalists. I don't even think Gary probably remembers that. Or do you? All right. The incipient idea that Roosevelt is casting is that one group of Americans are royalists over against another group who are not royalists. And it's a classic example of envy being used as a motivating tool. The idea then was to pull down the economic royalist so that the economic egalitarianism as fueled by envy could be established. And of course, we still hear echoes of this kind of thing in our political campaigns. But this idea of all belonging to the same social class in terms of envy and what it does applies not only to the money, but to any class of people who have developed any kind of superiority. Envy works to eliminate categories of superior and inferior so that we can all be the same, all belong to the same social class. We see this working out in our children's contests, where it's insisted that everyone that participates gets a medal and all are winners. Again, this is well-intentioned, but such a mindset reflects the work of envy, which insists that all must be what? The same. The refusal to recognize the achievers does not lift up those who have tried but failed, but instead pulls down those who have tried and succeeded. Envy has done its work on a collective basis. The third example, first one, all thinking alike, second one being all belong to the same social class, the third one, all must have the same patrimony or heritage or inheritance. You might call this familial envy. Remember, all of these are considered as what envy looks on a culture-wide basis. It becomes institutionalized among a people. So this patrimonial envy or this familial envy works to